Good morning. Today we continue our series on recovering healthy solitude. This is part two then of this three-part series. Today we will be looking at a bit more deeply than we did about a month ago about recovering the monk within. Next week, the third part of the series will be about recovering the mystic within. Last week, the first part of the series, we dealt with the wounded solitary in the contemporary world, or what contemporary solitude looks like. Briefly, a recap. In our modern world today, solitude is a solitude that leads nowhere, meaninglessness. It might be freedom from confrontation with one's significant other or family, or not being in a relationship, or loneliness, meeting the void, boredom, the blues, depression, fear of not being successful, or solitude as enjoyment of one's possessions and having more things or different things than anyone else. Solitude as uniqueness, as privacy and accumulation of private property. Solitude as protection from the outside by locks, gates, and security systems. Or solitude as punishment, punishing our prisoners by putting them into solitary confinement. Or solitude by withdrawing love. Or solitude by excommunication from a society, a club, or religion. Or from family, feeling of being left behind. Solitude, finally, we talked about as loss of self, self-abandonment, or the fear of someone else abandoning us. Solitude is vulnerability. Basically, what we've been looking at then is for our society today, then, contemporary solitude is about being wounded. And feeling that being wounded at the level of soul, and really feeling that solitude is a bad thing. Solitude is not something that is valued in our society. If you're alone going somewhere, we talked about that, huh? If you're alone going somewhere, showing up somewhere, be it a film, restaurant, or the park, you're looked at as being a very strange kind of person. So. Sense of solitude and solitariness, which has been part and parcel of centuries of spiritual experience, spirituality, our society doesn't value, it seems to me, when I take a look at it. We also tried looking at the positive aspects of a solitude that sometimes is imposed. A solitude that is imposed, let's say, by going into treatment somewhere, or going into a hospital, or perhaps even entering a monastery, or a convent, or becoming a hermit, or going back to nature, whatever. That the value of solitude can be in the separating from one's family and community in order to see more clearly the patterns or the negative patterns that operate in the family, even in culture as a whole, in government, general social opinions, sort of defeating one's over-dependence on family and superficial society, to begin critiquing general opinions of what is real and unreal. In some degree, solitude affords that, because we can begin to reflect on the realness or unrealness of values. So, at one level, solitude then means, paradoxically, to see deeper relationships at work. How will I act within the society that I'm a part? What is my relationship to nature? Who am I? Where are my roots and origins? Solitude affords an ability to look at these questions if we use solitude healthfully. And lastly, we talked about the inability, if you will, for emptiness, loneliness, pain, if you will, anger, all of these feelings that we have, the inability, or let's just say the neglect would probably be a better word, the neglect that organized religions often have been guilty of because of their lack of allowing the self a solitude of reflection and understanding about their relationship to God, themselves, society. So when we become baptized or bar or bas mitzvah, we gain membership in an organized religion, perhaps. But where is the sense of solitude? Where is the sense of understanding the limits of ourself? But going on one's own individual path of understanding, oftentimes that's not cultivated. And so we get membership and we move through these profound rituals without a proper understanding, also without a sense that failure and limits and loss are all a part of the self's growth and spiritual development. And this can only really be experienced when we touch upon the core solitude that exists within ourselves, whether we are with others or not. And in the core solitude, perhaps, affects us most readily, most profoundly, when we are experiencing some pain, when we are experiencing some loss, some loneliness, where we feel a lack of connection or disconnection, or we experience the void, if you will, right? We experience an emptiness. To bring back solitude in the religious community, in any religious community that we are a part, to bring back solitude is precisely to honor the sense of loss and limits, failure. That these are all not only okay and all right, but they're absolutely necessary. Combined with, of course, this wonderful encouragement that we certainly should get, right, in realizing our potentials. Because that's also what all of this is about, what the cultivation of solitude is about, and the cultivation of more profound spiritual community is about, is recognizing unlived potentials, but also limits. So today, the monk within, I would like to talk to you about, we need to set this up a little bit. What in the heck is monasticism anyway? What is the difference between Christian monasticism, let's say, and Eastern monasticism? And do we, everybody sitting here, do we have a monk within that is untapped? I consider it a potential. So when I'm speaking about this, I'm not giving you a lesson so much in history, but want to provide for you a possibility that your solitude can be highly productive if we recover the lost treasures, if you will, some of the lost treasures of spirituality, one of which is ancient Christian monasticism and Eastern monasticism, perhaps bridging those. And how can we discover the monk within? And perhaps doing that will afford us an understanding of those periods of loss, failure, disconnectedness, experience of the void and emptiness. Okay? So that's the why and wherefore that I speak to you about monasticism today. Now, for the East, let's begin with the East, because that's the oldest form of monasticism we have in the East. It's about 7,000 years old, the monk. Female and male. 7,000 years old. In fact, it was the monks, the Eastern monks 7,000 years ago, who discovered Hindu religion, which they often refer to as the eternal religion. So it's right off, it's very distinct from Christian monasticism, right? Because Christian monasticism was coming out of a framework already of an organized religion. Okay? Disciples under the founder Jesus, who had opted to live out a life of intense religious spiritual practice. Okay? But followers of Jesus. Unlike Christian monasticism, right off the get-go, Hindu monasticism, beginning 7,000 years ago, actually founded the very core and essentials of the Hindu religion. Okay? Now, what we're going to lead to eventually is a combination of Christian and Hindu monasticism and spirituality, which three individuals have cultivated. And I think it's very, very important for the world, absolutely crucial for the world. But to begin with, the Eastern monk defined the whole Hindu tradition and looked upon monasticism as the final stage of personal development, okay? I believe it was the fourth stage, beginning with the student stage, okay? And the student stage meant that any person, any individual, at age 12, that's interesting too, because Jesus was found in the temple at age 12, but at age 12, began studying his or her religious tradition, the language, the ancient scriptural language. Now in Hindu it was Sanskrit, okay? If we were to look at that model here for the West, we would be studying Hebrew and Greek, right? The languages of the gospel. Alright? Or the languages of the Old and New Testament. So the student would begin a period of 12 years studying the languages, studying the scriptures, and would go to some form of religious gathering and teaching every day for 12 years. When I look at that, I have to respond, you know, what kind of model do we have here? Well, if you happen to go to some kind of private religious school, that might happen, right? Or if you're going to a public school and then maybe once a week you'll have study Bible study, correct? Or you'll have temple where you'll go to is it a yeshiva to study scripture? But it's not this, certainly not this daily immersion in sort of the sacred traditions. But that was the first stage in personal spiritual development, was the stage of the student for the Hindus. After 12 years, which would be age 24, one then became a householder. That was the second stage of development. And the householder stage meant that one married, one had a family, and one tended to the parents until one's hair turned white. So this was a spiritual, highly spiritual stage on the development, okay, for the ancient East, correct? And when their hair turns white, they then entered a stage of retirement, which is stage 3. And retirement did not mean sort of discovering some hobby now that the children are gone. No. You know, it didn't mean sort of some kind of even entrepreneurship, that now that one is not engaged in full-time job, but maybe a part-time job and then doing other things, maybe getting into the Winnebago and going on a great vacation. No. For the ancient Hindus, the third stage of spiritual development, which was it was called the forest dweller stage, or the stage of the hermit. Okay? We're not yet at the stage of the monk. But the third stage was the hermit or forest dweller. Once one's hair turned white and one raised one's family, okay, one would retire into a hermitage to begin very intense meditation practices and to seek for the realization of the higher self. The fourth stage would be the stage called the monk. In Hindu terms, the sannyasi, the male sannyasin, female, would go into a final period of wandering. And what this meant is a detachment from all of what the world sees as successful, as valuable, and enter a stage of wandering, and oftentimes residing in a community and being the spiritual leader or spiritual guide of that community. And the community then would learn daily spiritual practices toward their own enlightenment, and the sannyasi or sannyasin, female monk or male monk, would reside at the center of that community as their spiritual guide. Now that's an interesting model, isn't it? Okay? Interesting model. I can't help but think of Tolstoy, actually. And Tolstoy was Russian. He was not, you know, Hindu. But Tolstoy attempted to live that out. Anyone, reading A Life of Tolstoy, people thought he was absolutely crazy when all of a sudden he got his hair turned white and he moved into solitude much more as a writer and ended up leaving his wife and family in wandering and died in a farmhouse. He tried to embrace that whole, and he was a landowner, very wealthy to our standards, okay, but left everything in that final stage, attempting to live out this final stage of detaching and depossessing oneself of all that the world considers valuable, or superficialized society considers valuable. Okay. Now, when we look at Western monasticism, we see something very different at one level, because Western monasticism wasn't looked upon as a kind of stage that one moved through in terms of Christian monasticism. It wasn't so much a stage, but it was a calling or a vocation that one might realize one had at a certain age. Could be 15, could be 25, could be 30, 40. It would be more of a vocation and calling to separate oneself from society. But not looked upon as a stage at all, but more as a vocation or calling. Christian monasticism began, I believe, around the 3rd or 4th century with St. Anthony, who leaves Roman Christianity to go into the deserts of Egypt because he has found that Christianity in the cities has become ridden with politics and superficiality and a real kind of social scene. And, you know, Emperor Constantine, in fact, who himself was baptized Christian in Rome, baptized everybody Christian. You were a nobody if you weren't Christian in the Roman Empire in the 4th century. And Emperor Constantine baptized everyone because he was wanting a kind of universal religion that everybody would live, you see. Well, what happened as a result of that is it became watered down for some people, to some people's view. So there were a few Christians who left Rome and went into the deserts of Egypt. But they went out as sort of single warriors out in the desert. Well, as we know in the human story, you can't be alone for too long. People always will follow you somewhere. And so folks began to build houses around St. Anthony and ask for his teaching. So other Christians began leaving these urban cities and going to the desert to ask Anthony for his wisdom. Now, along with this also is St. Pachomius, who is the origins of Christian monasticism, St. Pachomius in the Alexandrian desert. This is a bit more community-oriented from the very beginning, where one does not go out in solitude, but one, a religious community, separates oneself liminally from the urban world and begins to intensely look at spiritual values and live a life in common, much like the Acts of the Apostles. And that was under St. Pachomius. His inheritor was St. Benedict, and that was the founder of the monastic community that I joined years ago. So eventually St. Benedict, in the 6th century, founded this community, whereby female monks and female nuns, separate of course, would have these communities of intense prayer, learning and meditation, and common work, and they would live in common, attempting to live out the Acts of the Apostles. But quite a radical kind of vocation and calling. Eventually, we would have developed Monte Cassino. If anybody may have visited the Abbey of Monte Cassino in Italy, one sees the roots of Benedictine monasticism. Okay? Now, the vows that the monk took should be interesting to you. The vows were threefold. One vow was, the most important one, was conversion of the inner life. In other words, it was an ongoing conversion of one's awareness on one's relationship to God, and the dedication of one's life daily would be an ongoing conversatio, which means change. Conversion means change in the Latin. So one would daily attempt to change oneself by changing one's inner attitude and awareness through meditation, prayer, and work. That would be one vow. The second vow would be one of stability. This is under Saint Benedict, because under Benedict's time, some monks would go to one monastery, and when they didn't like it, they'd go to another. Okay? So Saint Benedict established a rule of stability, saying if you're going to be in one monastery, you should stay in one. So that was the second. Stability. And the third was obedience to an abbot, a master, a guru. So the abbot or the spiritual father of the community, there would be obedience to this father. Okay? It was not poverty, chastity, and obedience, which some of you Catholics here present may remember. That's what priests ended up taking, those vows. Now that happened, that occurred in the late Middle Ages when priests who were at that time married, by the way, not bishops, but priests were married, also had freedom from paying taxes, but would also acquire land and could give it to their children. So you had this big reform in the late Middle Ages where priests were asked to put on the monastic vow, which implied were celibacy, poverty, chastity, and obedience. So priests began to be seen more like monks so that there could be some reform within these priests who were acquiring more and more and more property in Europe, and the emperors were threatened by all this. That separation of church and state. Okay? So in the history of Christian, but what we see developing here is what? Well, what we see developing here is that solitude and separation, right, or the spiritual life in terms of some advanced spiritual life for the West, for us, is sort of meant for priests, ministers, monks, and nuns. Right? The rest of the folks, the lay people, what is implied is, well, they don't really know. Right? So what happened is, for a lot of Christian communities and for most, we didn't learn the meditation skills that only the monks knew. Many of us didn't even know how to read Scripture. In fact, Scripture was only in Latin and in Greek and in Hebrew, and only monks could decipher those texts until Martin Luther came around the 14th century, 15th century, and translated the whole business in German for the German community in Europe. And that totally transformed the whole consciousness of the Western world in Europe. Okay? But for the most part, all of these exercises of intense contemplation or prayer or meditation to lay folks was absolutely non-accessible. And so I think, this is my intuition, having been on both sides of the fence, being a religious or Western monk for a number of years, and now being in the world society, being married, etc. My intuition is that the lay person is looked upon as being kind of a second-class citizen of the religious life. Isn't that true? Sort of a second-class citizen. Not really practiced, not really spiritual enough like those people who might be ministers or nuns or monks, etc. So real lack of spiritual self-esteem, I think, is at the core of Western consciousness. I think this is a real problem. Because any of the really enlightened sages, and that includes Jesus, of course, talked about cultivating this inner solitude and the monk within, wherever one was and whatever station one was in. And the core rule was love, right? And universal love, loving one's enemies, and that was really the cultivation. That was the important thing. And it didn't matter about where one's station might be. In fact, Jesus often railed against religious officials, right? Their arrogance and grandiosity, and their keeping often the mysteries and truth from the everyday person. So Jesus was certainly what one would call a sannyasi, correct? In the Hindu tradition, that's why a lot of Hindus consider Jesus a highly evolved sannyasi. So they look upon Jesus with high reverence. But Jesus was one that would hobnob with the second class citizen, and that was his focus, because he believed that there was no second class citizen anyway. In fact, if Jesus had any bias, it was toward the religious officials of his day. He thought they were really become the second class citizens, many of them. But it was the everyday person that really was his concern. All right? And there has been a mystical tradition from the time of Jesus, by the way, which we'll get into next week, that has always kept this stream, the importance of love and taught love of one's enemies, no matter what one's station was, and bringing one's solitude and mysticism within the world. St. Francis of Assisi, Hildegard of Bingen, etc., etc. But really, for the most part, we haven't been introduced to a lot of that stuff, have we? We don't really know a lot about it. For us, for the most part, when I look at the typical layperson of the West, we're sort of obligated, and we have a duty to come to church somewhere or a temple somewhere once a week and sort of listen to a sermon, right? And maybe give some kind of tithe, and then go on with the rest of our life and build up enough guilt and shame around how we've lived during the week so that we really feel obligated to go somewhere on Saturday and Sunday or sometime, right? Right? And then we'll leave it for a while, especially if we go off to college or leave mom and dad, right? And then if we get married, we might come back into the church and religion, especially if we have kids, because we don't want our kids raised as pagans. And then we try our hand at it again, right? And then, of course, if we get sick somehow, we have a crisis, or we lose someone in a funeral, we might discover it again, right? And come back to God, always by the 911 prayer version. Right? I've never met anybody that was dying of cancer that didn't discover God all of a sudden. I've met very few people who entered treatment or even the 12 steps if they bottomed out enough that they haven't discovered God. This is sort of the way of the West. One always discovers, seems to me that one, not always, but the majority of folks discover God through extreme emergency measures. Isn't it true? For the most part. And then we try to get back into it, and then we kind of lose momentum again, right? And we kind of sort of sense we have this loss of connection to an emotionally present higher power, a highest power. We can't seem to get it going. Personally, I don't think it's our fault. I think the fault is in lack of spiritual mentorship, lack of spiritual guidance, lack of learning techniques of meditation and prayer, the lack of being empowered as spiritual citizens in the world. I don't think it's anyone's fault that many of us perhaps have experienced that, or have undergone baptisms, or have undergone bar or bas mitzvah, some kind of religious ceremony, didn't feel like we really felt it or understood it. I don't think it's our fault. And I know you hear me say that a lot, but I think it needs to constantly be said. But it's our lack of having experienced true rites of initiation and looking at personal development as spiritual development, as one thing, not as a particular special kind of calling. So my deep opinion is, we have to begin bridging the Eastern sense of monasticism as a stage, or the spiritual stages, if you will, the monk within, it sort of begins being cultivated from a very early stage, right? To begin taking that model and putting it also with the model of vocation and calling of Western monasticism, and kind of bridge those two and interconnect them. Now, there was a tradition in Eastern monasticism that suggests some people could sort of get enlightenment at a very young age, sort of have that God self realized, have a spiritual experience, a religious moment, very, very young, and struggle with kind of understanding that their whole life, and go through cycles and periods of sort of awakened, unawakened, but had an early religious experience. And I think this connects to the core of some Western experiences of the monastic. Sort of having a religious experience at any time in one's life. And I think many of you sitting here have had those experiences, but didn't know what to do with them, didn't know how to understand them. What experience am I talking about? Transcending the body, near-death experiences, an experience of total unity with the cosmos, perhaps some of those even instigated by your drug use. Of course, you have a whole lot of guilt about that. You know, but being sort of mood altered or taken out of the mundane everyday world, all of a sudden you had an aha. That's an experience. Some of you may have experienced a morning sunrise or a sunset, or seen or experienced the love of a favorite animal, and just knew that they were wise. They had a spirituality about them because of their ability to love you so much, right? Or some of us, I've talked to many of you who had experiences hunting, where all of a sudden you didn't want to shoot the elk or the deer or the bird. You just put your gun down and you just looked and observed and saw the beauty and the elegance and the reverence. You said, I don't even want to shoot this. I just want to be a part of this experience. My God, it's so beautiful. Look at this. I think all of us have had tremendous spiritual experiences. The experience even of falling in love is a spiritual experience. We know how we need to, because it mood alters us. It brings us out of our sense of mundane self, right? But we don't know how to put it in the context of spirituality because I think we've really been uneducated. And oftentimes we even shame the very experiences that should be a part of our spirituality. So the Eastern monk considered the last stage in one's life after marriage, and the Western monk kind of a separate lifestyle of solitude, a calling. It seems to me needs to be bridged. The East-West connection I want to give to you today, and I think this is very important for history. Ramana Maharshi, in 1879, lived from 1879 to 1950, was a South Indian sage. He was awakened at age 17 to a higher self, to the God self, and he experienced the bliss of this, the self, the God within, if you will. Experienced the kingdom of heaven that Jesus talked about. And then he dwelt in solitude, but was eventually surrounded by devotees who wanted his teaching, and he eventually entered, he allowed a community to emerge after him. Now, the connection here is that a French Benedictine, Henri Lassau, in 1910, he was born in 1910 and lived to 1973, came to India in 1948 and sat at the feet of Ramana Maharshi and was awakened himself and realized the higher self. And he began to work at this ecumenical reconciling of Hindu and Christian tradition. And then in 1968, another Benedictine, Beat Griffiths, carried on the tradition of Henri Lassau, the French Benedictine, and spent his final years in a hermitage in the Himalayas. I was introduced to Beat Griffiths' work, his wonderful book, if you ever wish to read it, called Return to the Center, when I was living myself in a Christian monastery. But it's the words of Ramana Maharshi that I wish to share with you today, because I think it can teach us something about the spiritual path and cultivating solitude. It was Ramana Maharshi who began speaking. Of many who may have had an experience of enlightenment early in their life and continue to gradually increase their awareness and make sense of it throughout their life. And Maharshi talked to a beginner who wanted to give up his job and family to be one with God. Maharshi said the following. He said, God is always with you. Renunciation doesn't mean giving away your money or abandoning your home. True renunciation is something else. It is actually merging in the world and expanding your love to embrace the whole world. Isn't that wonderful? Expanding your love to embrace the whole world. He said, great souls who have abandoned their homes have done so not out of aversion to family life, not out of hating the family life, but because of their large-heartedness. They're all embracing love to all of humanity and to all creatures in the world. I thought that was very important for us to hear. Okay? So this seems to me is the key to discovering true solitude is about wanting to understand the lesson of love so that we can love more profoundly. And I remember a master who taught me in the monastery something like this when I was undergoing one of my fasts, you know, and wanting to embrace the truth of the universe so I could reform everybody who I was living with. And I was walking along the footpath, and a monk who I thought I really respected him just by his energy, you know. I was walking by him, and he said, come and follow me. And I said, oh my God, where are we going? Yes, indeed, Master Allah, I've come behind you. And I said, I finally gotten his attention. He can see now that I'm fasting, and I'm praying, and I'm waking up earlier than anybody else. I'm the first one in the stalls, you know, to pray. And I look at everybody else going, yeah, they're late, they're not dressed. You know, I was, you know, really, I was saying to myself, thank God that they've had me here. Because this place is going to hell in a handbasket, you know. So I mean, I'm following this monk. And he leads me downstairs into the, you know, called the catacombs, you know, the monastery. There are these chapels where monks sometimes prayed in their solitude, and priests who were monks would also celebrate Mass. And I followed this monk, and I thought we passed his room. I thought, we're not going to his room. We end up in the place where we eat, the cafeteria, and we go into the kitchen. And he opens the refrigerator, he takes out some cheese and bread and some apples, and he puts it on the table. He says, eat. I said, God, I'm sharing lunch with this enlightened sage. And I said, no, thank you. I'm fasting. He said, eat. Eat. Eat, novice. So I ate, and I thought he was going to teach me something. And he gets up after he sees me that I've eaten enough. He sort of feels satisfied and leaves the table. I thought, well, that was rude of him. Brings me all the way here, and I'm sitting at the table and I eat. What's going on here? Of course, the point was, as I was way off course, grandiose, arrogant, wounded in my narcissism, and didn't understand at all the meaning of fasting. I had to first learn how to eat. I had to learn the notion of community and community within the monastery. Another monk told me too, when I asked him about a certain Eastern meditation that I wanted to do, and he said, it doesn't really matter what you do, kid. He said, after you do the meditation or your prayer, I don't care what it is, you can do a Hindu meditation, you can do any kind of meditation, you can stand on your head and spit wooden nickels. He said, no matter what you do, after it's over, do you feel closer to the world? Do you feel like you love it more? Do you feel closer to people you hate? Is your heart expanding? Do you feel like you have a bigger heart? If this happens, then whatever you're doing is right. And I share that with you. I can bring that to you from the forest, from the mountaintop. It doesn't matter what you do. It really doesn't. If you're worried about, you know, is this bad? Is this evil if I'm reading this? You know, just ask yourself after you finish, are you more loving of people who you're with, who you live with? Are you more compassionate? Are you less judgmental? Is this helpful? Because you see, Solitude for these monks were very important, but it was a solitude to learn the lesson of love and to learn awakening and to see themselves and to see how often we're so mistaken about so much what we think is spirituality. And personally, I think now that I'm in the world and in attempting to recultivate my monastic values, if you will. And the monastic value, very, very simply, is a value that cultivates interiority and cultivates transcendence, but transcendence through facing the self of the interior. And I'm going to talk a lot about that next week. In other words, a lot of us want to transcend by just getting the heck out of Dodge, right? Or we've tried to transcend by our medicating, right? We tried to transcend by, I won't allow that person to be angry, I'm not going to get angry with that person, I'm above that, right? Or a lot of us have sought going to the Himalayas or the East or even California, to learn transcendence, to sit at the foot of some guru, right? And to get out of the world. Well, actually, the enlightened sages of the world, and that includes Jesus and Buddha, and Ramana Maharshi, the enlightened sages suggest that the only way that I can transcend is through really facing my demons inside and learning simply how to befriend myself, learning a healthy interiority whereby I go inside and begin to face my demons within. So I learn how to befriend those demons within, so then I won't have a lot of enemies outside and create a lot of war and violence outside. Now, I'm convinced that a lot of the reason why we don't know how to do that is because we haven't been given teachers and mentors, and we haven't been given a story that makes sense, a spiritual story that makes sense, so that can be a cultural container for our going within and facing our demons. Now, I think we're beginning to create one through the inner child movement, through family therapy, through the 12 steps. I think we're beginning to create a new myth, a new story by which we can look and face our demons, face those pains within ourselves and do some healing work. I think the problem is we don't know. We've got a lot of spiritual gyms out in the world, but we've been using the physical gyms and the intellectual gyms, GYMS, the exercise places. I mean, come on. You can't go a block without seeing some clear glass, and all these people doing these exercises, right? And if you get cable, you can see like people, pumping up, right? And even ingesting strange foreign substances in their bodies in order to and they're exercising. I mean, they will do anything. They will disavow every. They are so sacrificed. They are so ascetic and disciplined. They will sacrifice everything for their self-image of physically building themselves up. We're calling it bodybuilding. or aerobics in the sky. And these are physical gyms. And the other is the mental gym. Just go to any university or academic university or look at the books, the self-help books, right? You can't go a block without being able to go to the mental gym of your choice. Bookstores, academic institutions, etc. So our culture, our society is really inundated with the physical gyms and mental gyms where we can exercise to our heart's content. And it's quite an ascetic kind of activity. It takes a lot of this but what's happened to us? I believe we don't know about the emotional gyms and the spiritual gyms, and I believe that a lot of spiritual gyms are emptying. What are the spiritual gyms? They're the Jewish temples, they're the Christian churches, they're the Islamic mosques. They're emptying. The spiritual gyms are emptying because we don't know what to do with the equipment.